Hello? Venerable Children's under the weather. Probably not quite like it is in the East Coast, but she's not. She has a cold. I don't think she's that cold, though. So tonight we're going to do a review, and she'll, I imagine, be back next week. So let's start with our motivation for our time together tonight. We're going to be doing a review on meditative stabilization. The six perfections that we're reviewing, they contain the whole of the path to awakening. And all of these lead to the wisdom, the profound emptiness. This is the core of the teaching. All of the 84,000 teachings that the Buddha taught flow into and arrive at the profound emptiness. And so why is this the core of the teaching? And it's because all of the sufferings that we undergo, that every sentient being undergoes, arise from this basic misconception, this misunderstanding of how things exist, the way things are. It's a misconception about the nature of reality. And what's completely contradictory to it is the wisdom that understands correctly emptiness of inherent existence. So this is the direct antidote that we need to develop, and all of the Buddha's teachings flow into us having this realization. So this is this misconception that we all carry, unless we've got realizations to dispel it, uproot it. This is the misconception that causes all the different kinds of suffering. So in order to develop that realization, let's set our aspirations to be able to develop serenity, concentration. This is a mind that is so peaceful and calm. It's free from all the different kinds of coarse afflictions. And it's clear and powerful. And it can allow us to stay on a virtuous object for as long as we wish. And so let's develop our confidence, our faith, and have some trust in the benefits of developing serenity. It's a joyous state of mind that takes delight in meditation. And let's use this tool to realize emptiness and use this tool to eventually practice Tantra. We need to have an extremely stable mind that can focus on the ultimate truth. So let's set our motivation tonight to learn about this topic, to develop ourselves in all of the six perfections, and to do this so that we can become fully awakened and relieve every being of every suffering by teaching them, inspiring them, doing what we can to benefit beings. So we're going to primarily focus on some preliminary information that kind of sets the context, and then talk about the six kind of causes or conditions or situations, you might say, that we need in order to develop calm abiding. And I chose this topic because it's more at the beginning of the top of the subject matter when we talk about this perfection, but also really because when I read about this years ago, I was living here, and I think it was not the first time I had read it, but I read about it while I was living here in this book by Jin Lamrempo, which is a really excellent book. It really follows Lama Tsongkhapa's way of presenting this topic very well, very closely, uses the same outline. And I realized that for me, these things were very alive in terms of how we're living our life here. I just really think of these topics as like, this is how we need to be living here. That was my thought. And so I invite you tonight, as I go through some of this information, to raise your hand, and if you have comments about how you think this might apply to your own practice now or to your life here, and even if people online have ideas of how this might apply, you know, just make it real to your own practice, your own situation. My own aspiration is, I find, you know, these types of practices very beneficial for my mind, and I have the aspiration to develop this capacity much more than I have. I don't have much, but I have a lot of aspiration in this direction, and I feel that, I think that the more I work on these things now, the easier it's going to be. I mean, just think about when you're sitting in the meditation hall and you're, even in the winter when we're doing retreat, what's happening with your mind and what's keeping you from doing this? If you work on this now, these things that are presented here, then it all just becomes so much easier. And if you don't, it will never happen. It will be impossible. And it's quite clear. So anyway, just to try to stay to the script, this topic, what Lama Tsongkhapa does is he talks about the last two perfections kind of together at first and talks about the benefit of developing serenity and insight. I'm just going to focus on the serenity parts, but I think this helps us to understand even this presentation of the conditions we need much more fully. And he says that all of the good qualities of the Mahayana and the fundamental vehicle, not his translation, but mine, are the results of serenity and insight. So then there's a quote from Lama Tsongkhapa puts in his text from a Mahayana sutra, and it says, "Child of good lineage, this list should inform you that faith in the Mahayana of the Bodhisattvas, and indeed everything resulting from the Mahayana, comes from accurately reflecting on the facts and meanings with an undistracted mind." So this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to have an undistracted mind that's one-pointed, that can reflect on the facts, the meanings of the teachings. You know, we listen and debate and learn and this and that, and we're trying to understand the meanings of the teachings so that we can then meditate on them. And this is like the discerning wisdom that we're trying to develop, the insight part. So we need an undistracted mind to do this. That's the serenity part. And then we need the discerning wisdom part, which is the insight part. We need to combine those. So in order to achieve all of the good qualities, we have to have this kind of sustained analysis with discerning wisdom. And we have to be able to stay one-pointedly focused on the object of meditation. And you can't do this if your practice is one-sided. You have to have both analytical meditation and stabilizing meditation. So then Lama Tsongkhapa goes on to make this point that serenity and insight include all states of meditative concentration. And then he quotes Kamala Shila to back this up. And he says that Kamala Shila says, "Since those two, serenity and insight, include all states of meditative concentration, all yogis should at all times definitely rely on serenity and insight." And then he goes on to explain the nature of insight. And again, he's quoting from a sutra, which is the Sutra Unraveling the Intended Meaning. And it says, "While you dwell in solitude and properly direct your attention inward, you should attend to just those topics upon which you have carefully reflected." So when we're studying, that's, you know, the things that we're learning in teachings or studying, that's what we want to be reflecting on then. And then he goes on and says, "Your attention is mentally engaged by continuously attending inwardly. The state of mind wherein you do this and stay this way often, in which both physical and mental pliancy arise, is called serenity." So it's a really poetic and beautiful and accurate way of describing serenity. Is turning inwards to the point where you're able to continuously do this and develop these kinds of pliancies. And then that's part of the definition of reaching serenity. So you have to, of course, take an appropriate object and then hold it with an undistracted mind, with vigilance, focus your attention on it continuously. And then one thing that I wish I had really heard Lama Tsongkhapa say before, because it's something that I started to learn last retreat, is that Lama Tsongkhapa says, you focus your attention on this object and fix it to the object continuously so that your mind stabilizes of its own accord on the object of meditation. And this is something that I really, I'm sure I was never doing until last winter. I think something changed, and I feel like before last winter, I was always like trying to put my mind in a box and squeeze it, you know, like you're going to concentrate on this and you're not going to let it go. Just like this kind of, and now what I'm doing, I'm not saying I'm doing this right, but I'm saying, I think I'm closer because I'm not doing that. And I don't know. I'd have to really talk to a meditation master to find out if what I'm doing is correct. So I'll just leave you with Lama Tsongkhapa's words. Stabilizes of its own accord. So then when you produce this delight and bliss of physical and mental pliancy, then your state of meditative concentration will become serenity. So this comes about just through sustaining your attention inwardly without distraction on the object of meditation. And it's not contingent on you understanding the reality of the thing. That's the insight side of things. This is the serenity side of things. It's like the holding your mind there, just that part of it. So then he goes on to talk about insight. But that's not for this week. So what I want to talk about first here is some points that Jinlam Rinpa made that I think were quite helpful to me and surprising to me sometimes, and things that I've thought about ever since I first read these years ago. And what he said is, what he's talking about is what happens if you don't have the right motivation. And he's talking about how this will impede our progress in this regard. So he talks about unsuitable motivations. And the first one he talks about is if our motivation is something like about our reputation or having more acquisitions, more praise, more affluence, whatever it is. He says then that our whole practice will be less than significant. And that more than that, this kind of motivation will make the attainment of shamatha, of serenity, impossible. And then he supports this in this way. He goes on to ask, what is the attainment of serenity or shamatha? So the way he describes it, it's the access concentration to the first dhyana or first jhana, the first meditative stabilization. This is what Venerable Chodron was talking about. She was talking about the form realm, the meditative stabilization. So this is a different dimension of existence. This is the form realm. And in order to get to, in order to have that kind of attainment of a jhana, you have to turn away from sensual desires. So if you have these motivations that have any kind of attachment to the sensual or the desire realm, then that very motivation that you're having for your practice is going to become your primary obstacle to attaining serenity. You follow that? You're attaining something that has nothing to do with having, sensual types of desires. So that's the essential point. The mind that attains serenity is a mind that has gained the access concentration to the first jhana, which is included in the form realm. The form realm lies beyond the sensual realm, beyond the desire realm. So if your very aspiration is clinging to something that is of the desire realm, then your motivation is going to actually be an obstacle to fulfilling your own aspiration. So we have to be on the lookout for these things. I can see that in my own practice clearly. It's clear to me, and part of it I'm kind of bought into, and I think is actually good for me in a certain way, and I have to really keep that in a context of like a bigger picture of what I'm trying to do. And for me, it comes to I spend some time every day just working on getting my body, my mind calm, just so I can deal with myself, just so I won't be living unethically. Because if I don't do that, I'll just be like a bull in a china shop in terms of how I'm interacting with people. And I could just do that and make that my whole motivation, and that would be the end of the story. Completely, like, wow, this—it's actually kind—it's very pleasant to do. I quite enjoy this. It's the favorite part of my meditation in some ways. But if I just left it at that, I mean, that's the result I would get. That would be crazy. So I always put this in a bigger context. But it is something I've chosen to do, and I think is being a valid. I just think it's the right thing for me to be doing. If I had maybe more realizations, I wouldn't need to bother with this. I don't. So this is what I have. That's how I look at it. Okay, so then he says, look at your own practice to see the more mundane examples of this occurring. There's mine. So we have to look at these things, you know. And, you know, they might be things that we do purposely. I'm doing this purposely, and I'm finding this beneficial, and I'm hoping to actually go in this direction and deepen in this way. Whatever that looks like, I don't know. So then he talks about another unsuitable motivation, and this one is the one I remember first when I read this. Years ago, I wasn't living here yet, and I read this, and I was like, I was working still in healthcare, and I was like, really? I don't know. He says, another unsuitable motivation is the personal satisfaction that comes from serving others. You know, I was working in healthcare, so I'm like, well, really? That's one thing I enjoyed. You know, it was satisfying working with people in a lot of ways. There are a lot of things I liked about it. So then he gives the example, a doctor serves others. But if his principal motivation for serving is the satisfaction that he himself receives by serving and healing others, his effort becomes self-serving and self-centered. That motivation is centered entirely on the benefits attainable only in this lifetime. And then he applies it to meditative stability. And he says, this kind of motivation would be equally unsuitable for the cultivation of serenity. He always uses the word shamatha, but I'm going to just substitute serenity. So he says, if one works to attain serenity in order to bring benefit to beings, to other beings, but is ultimately interested in the personal satisfaction that's gained through something that seems altruistic, then that aspiration entails concerns for this life. And that, too, will become an obstacle to developing meditative quiescence or shamatha. You follow that? The mind that you're going to develop has to be quite subtle. And so if you're banking your motivation on like something that's self-serving, it's eventually going to get in your way, is kind of how I read that. And, you know, I can see how that would happen quite easily. Like, would you guys quit making noise and quit clicking your malas? I'm trying to concentrate here. That would be the gross form. You know, stuff like that. You know, there's so many ways that we can do that, you know. So, you know, take notes. Think about these things. We're doing this so we can improve ourselves. You might have some good examples, too. And then his third one, it's a little bit, I don't know, it's a kind of a little shift from those two. But he started just talking about the general practices we do, and you know, like our abbreviated recitations that we did before we started to turn on the mics and all that. So in there we have the seven limb prayer, and he talks about the seventh limb, the prayer, where we're doing the supplication. And in this context of developing concentration, he says, finally, one asks to be liberated from all the physical and mental conditions that might obstruct the cultivation of serenity. And in making this supplication to one's spiritual mentor, one should think, may the unmistaken realization of shamatha swiftly arise in the stream continuum of my being. And actually, this is something that I picked up from this book that I say to myself. May the unmistaken realization of shamatha swiftly arise in the stream continuum of my being. And the reason this is important is because we need to have an unmistaken realization of this. That's what he's trying to emphasize here, and that these practices that we're doing help us in this regard. So we need to ensure that we're unerring in identifying our own experience. People get lost when they do these kind of practices. I mean, I've met some people at the prison who have asked me questions. They have a lot of time, you know, and some of these people do a lot of meditation, and sometimes they don't know what the heck they're doing, and, you know, it's not, you can go down some weird paths that aren't going to take you to where you want to go. So, you know, we need to be able to identify our experience. And basically, we need to be able to rely on the great texts and teachers to help us in this regard. But what he's talking about here is these general practices that we do, these like the abbreviated recitations and all that's contained in those, which is a lot of teachings in itself. But those are some of the causes for attaining shamatha. So we need to do them consistently and conscientiously from the very beginning. And he says initially they might not seem very important, but neglecting them or treating them casually, even though it might not be evident in the beginning, will lead to obstacles or some kind of tangential path, which won't lead you to the development of meditative quiescence. So I think that these kind of pieces of advice he's giving about our motivation and kind of way we're trying to direct our activities are quite important. So then he goes on to talk about some suitable motivations. And he says the first step, you need something that will carry you, give you the momentum to carry the practice as long as it takes. You know, if you don't have a motivation that's suitable, you won't continue with things. So he's going to now address what are some meaningful or authentic motivations for developing our ability to concentrate in this way. And the first one is to attain rebirth in the form or the formless realms. But this isn't really a Buddhist goal. It's not a Buddhist goal. It is beyond this life, you could say, but it's eventually an event unsatisfactory. And there are practitioners who strive for that and attain that. And that would give a person probably enough meaningful motivation because it's so blissful, probably. I'm not sure what they're looking for, but I think this might be described in Hinduism. But at any rate, that he lists as the first one, but he then kind of throws it out right away because it's going to be eventually unsatisfactory for a Buddhist. So then the next one is to attain liberation or nirvana, which will cut the root of your suffering, the source of your suffering. And that is a very amazing achievement and a very powerful motivation. Unfortunately, if you're thinking the way we do, you're not going to be of any evident benefit to anyone else because you're going to be in a state of total inactivity, is how he describes it. So for us who are in the Mahayana, we want to have a motivation to attain full awakening. We need this kind of driving force to have the momentum to continue. And that he considers the most meaningful. And then, because we're just sentient beings, I love the way they, you know, just ordinary beings, I love the way they bring in things like, he talks about how Arya Davis says that just the aspiration to serve in and of itself is an aspect of serving others. So sometimes, you know, we aren't feeling like we're doing much for others, maybe. Maybe you're spending your whole time developing concentration. You're thinking, what am I doing? Where's my altruistic intention? But if you have that aspiration there, Arya Davis saying that in and of itself is a means of serving others. And I think that makes sense because if you take a longer view, you know, of your many lives, what you're developing in each one. Maybe in a certain lifetime, you have the conditions to develop calm abiding. So if you combine that with this kind of altruistic intention, as the lifetimes build up and your skills build up, you'll eventually put it all together, hopefully, and really be able to do just that. Does that make any sense? So recollecting this spirit of awakening can inspire us to train. And we do this, you know, one of the subcategories of we can be inspired to train other people to be able to develop this kind of ability to concentrate. And so we have to learn that ourselves. And one thing he said that was interesting, this is from Lama Tsongkhapa now. Lama Tsongkhapa says, after you've increased your stability in the altruistic intention, then aspire to attain high meditative stabilization and train in these. That was interesting for me. I hadn't noticed that before. So basically he's saying, you know, make your bodhicitta firm. Make it stable. He didn't say you have to have achieved it. He said, increase the stability of this spirit. After you have increased the stability of this spirit, aspire to the high meditative stabilizations and train in these. And I think that's really what they're doing in the Tibetan practice. They're making us like, don't get sidetracked with feel-good meditation until you've built up your understanding of the Dharma and the three principal aspects of the path, essentially, and the three higher trainings. You know, get the whole picture and get your motivation really strong so that will carry you in the right direction. That's how I see that. Okay, so then Lama Tsongkhapa goes on, says, even if you're unable to fully develop meditative stabilizations, you must strive to train yourself from time to time in one point in concentration to whatever extent you're able. So this is our opportunity. This is what we're able to do. From time to time, we can focus on this, especially when things are slower and when we're in our winter retreat. And then he goes on to say, if you do not do so, you'll be continually stained by the fault of breaking the precepts. See, that's what I find. I find that unless I keep my mind calm enough, I'm like, my ethics falls apart because I'm like too reactive. You know, I'm just like too reactive. It's much easier for me to hold my sense of integrity of how I want my values together if I am not on automatic, if I'm not feeling overwhelmed, if I'm more peaceful inside. I have less afflictions I have to deal with then. It's just a no-brainer, really. So, you know, that's my example. And then he says, okay, so he's saying, if you don't do this, you will be continually stained with the faults of breaking the precepts. Of course, you probably won't have enough mindfulness to keep them either. And in other lives, you will find it most difficult to learn the trainings for entering the many doors of the bodhisattva's meditative stabilizations. Whereas if you never give up your effort, even in this life, your mind will become steadily less distracted, making your accumulation of virtue more powerful. That's the thing that attracts me to this. Having more ability to concentrate is having a more powerful mind. Then you can direct your mind to virtue more easily. You know, it's just, I've seen this in during my ordination, some of the things I've read, you know, from the Chinese tradition that make this so clear too, very similar ideas. So in future lives, if we do this, we'll have the physical and mental bliss and a joyful mind, and then we can easily complete the perfection of meditative stabilization. So that's what Lama Tsongkhapa is saying. And then Jinlam Rempa goes on to say that even when we're doing our meditative sessions, you know, when you're in the midst of a session, if your mind wanders off, let the cultivation of bodhicitta bring you back into the meditation. So we don't have to like divorce our bodhicitta motivation from the development of shamatha. When our mind goes off, we can even use it to bring ourselves back. Like, you know, I have a purpose here. I have a motivation here to do this. So he goes on to say that the important thing isn't that we have actually cultivated fully perfected bodhicitta or fully perfected loving kindness. Even any approximation of that, of bodhicitta or loving kindness for the benefit of all beings, will accrue a lot of merit, great merit, he says, and that will be a favorable circumstance for us and will be helpful to develop serenity. So that's what he has to say about these kind of, you know, things that seem out of our reach sometimes. He's saying, don't let your mind think of it that way. Just go on, keep going. Just do what you can, and that will accumulate little by little, like every drop in a bucket, and things change, and you have more skills and more abilities. That's how it goes. So I call this part advice from the masters. And it's basically, it would be impossible for our efforts to be successful if we don't use the guidance of qualified teachers and the writings about this topic. It would just be impossible. It'd be like trying to fly a jet plane without reading a manual or something, you know? You know, like, so the problems the Navy's having right now. They trained all these people, like, they didn't train people on the boats in the last few years. They're revamping everything in the Navy right now because they're having all kinds of wrecks. Because they trained them all. They said, hey, just go read this book and go out there and do your thing. And now we're crashing in the ocean. And so they're going back to the way they used to train, where they had instructors and they practiced things and they didn't just give them a video, right? it's not so different, you know? You need instruction. You need guidance. You need proper instruction to do things well. It's kind of like that. So what General Rempa talks about is Milarepa. He had incredible difficulties, and he was molested by demons of great strength. He stood firm in the face of all these difficulties, overcame the obstacles, and gained great realizations, not in spite of them, but through them. This is the point. To me, it's like, if you're waiting for the perfect conditions to practice, you'll never practice. You just practice in whatever conditions you're in. That's how you practice. And so that's what he did. He actually used them. And, you know, and that's how he did it. So for him, he had to develop great equanimity in the face of whatever occurred. And that's what we need to do as well. So in that sense, we can't become so attached or repelled by things that appear good or bad to us. Think about what that does to your mind when you're trying to do your practices. Your mind is pulled left and right. How can you focus single-pointedly when you're letting your mind be attached and repelled, you know, all this attachment and aversion to things, how they, and all these appearances to the mind, this is good, this is bad, I like this, I don't like that. You don't get anywhere. So we have to, you know, recognize that and then have a stronger sense of purpose of something greater. So then, now that with that as a background, then we'll talk about these six conditions that we need in order to develop serenity. And the way Lama Tsongkhapa introduces it, he talks about that, you know, we're talking about developing the single point of concentration and the level of a coarse mind. And this coarse mind is related to our body, and it's related to external factors, the altitude we're at, the temperature we're at, the time of day, our physical health. All of these influence our ability to meditate because we have a coarse mind and we have a body. And you're just not going to go into your cave and turn down the heat and turn down the lights and everything's going to go copacetic. It's just not going to go like that. You've got a body and you've got a mind that's, who knows what it's doing. So what he's saying is that we have to have the appropriate conditions because we have a body, because we have a coarse mind. And if any of these are missing, it's very difficult to advance. You might be able to go through some of the nine stages, but you won't be able to attain serenity. So this is what I really highlighted. So we have to establish these six external and internal conditions before we embark on a retreat. That's what they say, before. You need these things before you start your retreat. And you have to have as many of them as possible in your daily life. And that's kind of the point of this whole talk tonight, is for us to look at this and treat this subject in that way, not just like, you know, when I go to my Alan Wallace retreat, I'll deal with this then. I don't think it's going to work so well that way. So what are the six? Okay, these are what we rely on for developing meditative serenity, these conditions. And I'll just list them first, the way that they're worded in the great treatise. Dwelling in an appropriate area, having little desire, being content, completely giving up many activities, pure ethical discipline, and completely getting rid of thoughts of desire, etc. And then he says, at the outset, a yogi should rely on the preconditions for serenity, which makes it possible to develop serenity quickly and comfortably. Okay, so we need to have, the first thing is dwelling in an appropriate area, and that has five attributes. Easy access, so food and clothing can be obtained easily. And it has to be a good place to live where it's not unsafe, like wild beasts and predators or enemies. then he says, on a good piece of ground, one that does not breed sickness, kind of like when the nuns were trying to live in California in that place where all the mold was. It's not suitable. It's not a suitable place. Everyone got sick and they had to abandon that place. It wasn't working. There's a reason why none of the Native Americans lived in certain places, you know, in this country. Offering good companionship insofar as your companions are ethically disciplined and like-minded. That's the fourth of these five attributes of dwelling in an appropriate area. And then being well situated, inasmuch as there are not many people about in the day and little noise at night. So he says them all fairly briefly. So one thing I wanted to share that Lama Tsongkhapa quoted Maitreya, and he says, the intelligent practice in a place which has blah, 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 all these various conditions. And I want to emphasize that because sometimes you hear people who don't think that this stuff doesn't matter, you know, like, you know, when he says where yogis can be comfortable, it's not like they're going to be like in something that's plush, but they need to have these certain conditions. And it's intelligent to have these conditions. So, you know, Maitreya says the intelligent practice in a place which is accessible is a good place to live, offers good ground and good companions, has the requisites for comfortable yogic practice. So, you know, Jinlam Rinpa says for a perfectionist, it could be very difficult to fulfill all these requirements, just as they are described in the scriptures. And that's the mind that's the part of that I like to listen to. He says we can come close, but I like to focus on the first part. It could be difficult, you know, for a perfectionist, but you have to realize that you don't need things perfect. You just practice, you know, you do what you can and then you just go forward. So he lists them fairly the same, a peaceful environment, in the sense that there's not a lot of human commotion during the day and a lot of noise, like dogs barking at night, stuff like that. The land, the earth itself, is a good place. The best location would be a place where great meditators have lived before and left their positive energy. This necessity of life, food, water, are easily attainable. And then the one that he fleshes out a little bit more is a good human environment, good companions who hold similar views or engaged in a similar practice. So holding similar views means you have similar attitudes and similar practice refers to behaviors of our body, speech, and mind, that the people are in accord, in harmony, essentially. And this accord can be natural or it can come about through effort. So what he's saying is that people aren't perfect, but they're all trying. You know, some people have to make effort to make that to happen. And then he talks about where they were, because he's giving these teachings at Cloud Mountain when they had that one-year retreat. You know, I think it was DFF was formed initially to invite Jinlam Rinpa to come to the U.S. and teach this one-year retreat at Cloud Mountain. So these teachings were given there. And Allen Wallace transcribed these, blah, blah, blah. But he says, here we have this condition. Come as close as possible, as almost anyone could have the necessary conditions, and he lists those. And then he says, but what we must do now is to be considerate and help each other when we can by being silent and unobtrusive. So, you know, they had really apparently pretty good conditions there. So that's the first one, dwelling in an appropriate area or a favorable place. The second and third kind of go together. The second is having little desire. And Lama Tsongkhapa says, so you don't strongly crave more or better robes, etc. The third is being content. You're always content to have even the poorest robes, etc. And then Jinlam Rinpa develops this more. And he talks about these are two causes. They refer to abandoning or setting aside your just mundane concerns for this life alone and totally dedicating yourself to the spirit of awakening, to attaining full awakening, right? And so he describes this explanation from Lama Tsongkhapa, you know, having few desires, not wishing for something better than what you already have in terms of food and lodging and all that. So what it would be like is instead of sitting there on the cushion and fantasizing, it would be better this way. I remember John Powell used to say that. He used to describe to me what his attachment was like. Everything could be just a little bit better. The tea he made, good, but just could be a little bit better. And this just plagued his mind. I remember him describing this to me. I was dealing with anger. He was dealing with attachment, so I had to learn from him. You know, it would be better this way or that. Your mind always, you know, it's kind of like the mind that picks faults too, you know, just, oh, this just not right. So when you have those kind of thoughts, that's going to bring out more activities of your body and your speech. And that's just going to be an obstacle to your meditation. So then the other side of the coin of that, from the first one, which was having little desire, the flip side of the coin is being content. So that's focus on the present reality and just being satisfied with what is adequate. What I have is good enough. Just, you know, your mind wants to want something different. Really? No. What I have is good enough. Just let it go so you can go back to what you're there for. That's why the motivation part is so important. If you lack this kind of contentment, this will give rise to so many kinds of activity, verbal and physical, and it will just clutter your practice, is what he says. And the point here is you have to have contentment in order for your practice not to be cluttered, which is your mind. So he says that these problems actually are more difficult for people who live in isolation in a remote area. It's probably because they have to go out all the time to get stuff, is the way I read it. Because he said here, you know, there at Cloud Mountain, you can just write a note, the staff will provide what you need, and we have a structure. And, you know, so that reduces some of the clutter. But, you know, if you think about it, if you have to go out shopping every week, say you're doing a retreat in your own home, you know, and then you have to go out shopping every week, you know, and just stuff like that, you know, when you have a situation that's set up like they had there, they didn't have to leave. They didn't have to do all this stuff to, you know, things were coming to them. They were taken care of in that way. So people who are alone don't have that a lot of times. And so they have to, it interrupts their practice. That's what he was saying. And then he says, we have the special danger in anticipating the end of the retreat and thinking about the desires we will have then, the hamburgers and ice cream that we can have then, the luxurious conditions that we'll return to. You see your mind doing that? The temptation will be to borrow distractions from a year hence and take advantage of them right now. That's what we do. Westerners are so clever, they can think of things way in advance. Unfortunately, planning ahead might not be appropriate right now. So that's good advice. So what the Abhidharma calls this is, it's called having great desire. Desiring things you do not now have. Desiring things that you do not have now, the great desire. So your mind's just like shopping or something. You're just like future tripping, whatever it is. So this is the opposite of contentment, is what he's saying. And all of this is kind of related to on the mundane level, right? So what when discontent comes to the mind, it's like a sharp focus of the mind, and you're just like, this isn't satisfactory. You know, that's where the mind is. And what you have to do is you have to just go exact opposite. This suffices. What I have is good enough. And just be content. Venerable Chodron says that this kind of contentment is rare in modern society. People always trying to get better and more, whatever it is. And so we have to combat a whole lot of our previous conditioning around this. And we have to go against the values of our society in order to develop contentment. So we're like swimming upstream in this one. You know, it's just like everything around you is like advertising, get this, get this. Like, how many products do they have to wash your hair with? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, it's like 20 kinds of toothpaste and 50 kinds of shampoo. And, you know, it's like more, better, better, more. So you have to kind of just, okay, this soap will work. Okay, and then the fourth one is completely giving up many activities. So you have to give up when you're doing these kind of retreats, like buying and selling things, doing a lot of socializing with anyone, householders, monastics, giving up pursuits such as medicine and astrology. Venerable Chodron talks about like being free from involvement in worldly activities and commotion, getting away from projects, letters, emails, unrelated books. You know, like don't start reading things that are unrelated to what you're doing. Taking care of family, all of those things are going to be distractions. And when you sit down and meditate, your mind is going to worry or plan or whatever. So that's the kind of thing that we can work on now easily. I mean, this is like a daily thing, practice here for us. So when Jin Lama Rinpa talks about this, he says this one, completely giving up many activities, is relatively clear. In general, during a retreat, a variety of activities should be avoided. No business transactions of any kind. Ordained people, non-ordained practitioner, it doesn't matter, shouldn't have a lot of personal contact with other people, no social activities. And so, you know, it's not hard for us to understand this. We can see from our own experience that when we have a whole lot of interpersonal contact, it either elates your mind or depresses it. You know, things go well and the mind's stirred up, or like that didn't go well and you get depressed. It's just like you're making your mind unsettled, and that's a real major obstacle to developing serenity. So we have to see what kind of activities we have that are superfluous, you know, unnecessary, and just avoid them. So that one's, I think, easy to understand. It might be harder to do than it is to understand. But seeing the importance of it, I think, is not hard to see. You know, I mean, just look at what are you thinking about when you're on the cushion? What pulls your mind off? I'm thinking about, you know, like water systems, you know, like, you know, it's just what I'm doing, you know, things I have to figure out. I have to think things through. Sometimes that's the quietest time I have to think, like, what needs to happen here? You know, it gets in the way. So when you get away from that, it's so much easier. Okay, and then the fifth one is pure ethical discipline. And Lama Tsongkhapa just, you know, very briefly says, you don't violate precepts. Doing deeds that are wrong by nature or wrong by prohibition, things that the Buddha said not to do, either in the case of vows of individual liberation or in the case of bodhisattva vows. If you do violate them through carelessness, you restore them properly with regret in accordance with the teaching. And Venerable Chodron said, live in pure ethical conduct. Keep whatever precepts and commitments you've accepted and at least abandon the 10 destructive actions. If we can't control our coarse speech and our coarse physical actions, and these are motivating us, we'll never succeed in getting rid and purifying the mental factors that prevent concentration because they're more subtle. So we have to kind of take care of the gross things first so that we can work on the subtle things that prevent our ability to concentrate. So this part of the Jin Lama Rinpa text, I didn't use too much of it. I think they actually had kind of mixed up one thing in there. It wasn't clear to me what they were trying to say anyway. But what was clear to me is that when you it's important to do purification. He had some good advice here, you know, about that. The 10 destructive actions that we did in this lifetime and previous lifetimes, we should be purifying those kind of things. I thought some of this stuff was interesting when he talked about, you know, there's different methods to do this. We're all familiar with these, but he talked about the Vajrasattva practice. You know how, I think, not sure if everyone here is aware of this, but it's said, and he talks about it here, that when you do that practice, why they say 21 mantras a day is because that keeps any unwholesome imprints from increasing, right? So, you know, you're just kind of keeping yourself at bay. Anything you've done, at least it's not going to increase if you do that practice well. So that's why we do that every evening, but, you know, we might need to do more, kind of clean things out rather than just keep them from increasing. So, you know, he suggests that to make this a daily practice for the retreatants when they were doing their shamatha retreat, and they did to do it in between sessions, do the practice daily and you know, using the four opponent powers. And then he says, this is interesting, it would be best for those who have taken commitments in terms of daily practices of a tantric nature to maintain them. If we let them slack off, we will be committing an infraction. Later on, when our concentration gets very strong, very stable, as time is growing short and we are squeezed for doing all those commitments, there are ways they can be altered or abbreviated with no problem. For the time being, however, do them completely. If you abbreviate them at the beginning and do not attain serenity, you will lose on both accounts. So he's just pragmatic. He was talking here, I think, at the beginning of the retreat, and it was a year-long retreat. But, you know, that's what Venerable has told us to do, too, is we do our commitments in between sessions in the winter and keep them going. And there's ways to make them a little, you know, shorter and this and that. But, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, you know, just do them in an abbreviated way. Keep your commitments going. And then the last one is completely getting rid of thoughts of desire, etc. And Lama Tsongkhapa says just a little on that. In the case of desires, contemplate their disadvantages in this lifetime, such as their leading to being killed or imprisoned, you know, or their disadvantages for the future, such as leading to like a rebirth in a miserable realm. Alternatively, eliminate all thoughts of desire and such by meditating with the thought that everything in cyclic existence, pleasant or unpleasant, is ephemeral and impermanent. Since it's certain that I will shortly be separated from all of these things, why should I crave them? So basically trying to get rid of craving and then the anger that it leads to when you don't get what you want and all that. And these are really things that are related to the eight worldly concerns. They're things that we're just wanting for this life generally. And again, Jinlan Rinpa goes back to this thing, like, once again, when you're trying to develop serenity, you're developing a mind that has gained access concentration to the first jhana. And that is in the form realm. That's beyond the desire realm. So what you're doing is having an aspiration. If you're, you know, if you're still like having these cravings and this and that, this is going to be an obstacle because it's not consistent with what you're trying to achieve. It's internally inconsistent. You know, you're trying to get to a realm that's beyond the desire realm, but your motivation for things is based on craving. It's just, you know, it's a no starter. And then from there, they kind of briefly go into some topics that help us, I think. Lama Tsongkhapa says that these points, that these six points actually come from, they were cut down. Let's see, maybe I took that out. They were 13, and then they were cut down to six. I think by Kamala Shila. So these are things that, these are causes and conditions that will help us newly develop concentration. It will help us to maintain existing concentration so it doesn't deteriorate, and it will increase or heighten your concentration. That's why we can look at these things now, because they're going to help us now to develop, and then whatever we develop, they're going to help us maintain, not have it, you know, deteriorate, and then they'll help us to improve. And of all of these, you know, we don't always have all of them, but they narrow it down to three. You have to have good ethical discipline. These are the three most important. Good ethical discipline, seeing desires as disadvantageous, and living in an appropriate area. So Dzongtompa says that we think the fault lies only in our personal instructions, and then we seek only personal instructions and we're unable to attain concentration. This is a result of not abiding under its conditions. So if you think about that, like when you think about what these six conditions are, it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to like not pay attention to those six, but I'm going to go in for personal instruction from the teacher, you know, but I'm not going to do the other six. And then you're wondering why you can't concentrate. That's what I think he's trying to say. Very pragmatic. you know, this doesn't work. So we have to do these practices. We have to understand the methods. We have to do the practices. We have to learn how what our errors are, to recognize them and the difficulties. And we need to do that before we go into any kind of strict retreat. And so in the Sanskrit tradition, there are major texts that are recommended, which you can read. There's a list of them I could give, but I won't take the time here. They're listed in the Great Treatise. Mainly what we have to have are realistic expectations. It seems like a lot of people think that they could just develop this no matter where they are or what kind of situation they're in, and then they get frustrated because they don't have realistic expectations. So I think it's important to understand more of what the masters teach on the topic so that you can, you know, apply it to your life and have realistic expectations so you don't abandon the practice. You know, it's not realistic to think that you can, you know, my job where I was working, like, 10-hour days are always 11-hour days, and then coming home, you know, and doing that 4 days a week and having a Wednesday off and the weekend off and then taking care of my house and working out and going to the grocery store and whatever else I was doing. It's just not so realistic to think you're going to develop single point of concentration in that with those conditions. But if you don't read these books, you might think that, and I think people do. So, you know, that's not a realistic expectation. But does that mean that we shouldn't try? No, that was very beneficial for me to work on breathing meditation and the different things I did. It helped me a lot, and it planted seeds for later. It was good for me at the time. It's kind of like, you know, one time when I first started my job as a physical therapist at this hospital, I taught a yoga class, and that was kind of like in an environment where people there just didn't even know what yoga was, you know. And I remember saying that any time I spend doing this is always time well spent. And actually, I learned that about exercise too. You know, sometimes you think you have to, I usually taught people you need to string together exercise to get the most benefit out of it, which is true. But actually, there's a research that shows that even one bout of exercise is beneficial to a person. It lowers your blood pressure, for example, even during and after that session. And, you know, so like one drop in the bucket isn't wasted is what it boils down to. It was true for when I did yoga. I always felt like every session was beneficial to me. You know, the time that we spend on doing things. My dad, one time, he was like a workaholic when he was doing this. He learned about TM, and he would take time out like for 10 minutes once or twice a day in the middle of his practice, and he would do that. I learned about it years later. I never knew at the time. And he said he had a lot of benefit from it. Yeah, you know, I don't think he kept it up, but he did it for a while. You know, my dad was pretty open-minded. So, you know, 10 minutes. And I've heard other stories from people who, you know, I've done some things very shortly, like this 40-day commitment that we just did, Venerable Children. The little thing I did, I just did it a few minutes a day. And it was very beneficial. I learned a lot, you know. So, you know, you shouldn't underestimate these things. They can have a lot of impact. So, let's see. So we have to let go of grandiose expectations of quick results. That's kind of like not ever going to help us. It's important that we try to have our practice, you know, continuous, daily kind of thing. It's important to start with short sessions to develop serenity. If you just push yourself and do long sessions, it's counterproductive, actually. It makes your mind real tight. And when the mind's tight, you don't want to go back to the cushion. You're supposed to actually feel good when you leave and you want to come back. That's the kind of mind. We want to have a gladness in the mind that we look forward to this. And then once you're able to do that, then you slowly increase the sessions. Any comments or comments? Not accepting questions.
With entering Varsa, we have the thing about not giving admonition. About criticizing. And I think that...
No, admonition is different than criticizing. Admonition is not criticizing, by the way.
Yeah.
If you're thinking it's criticizing, then you're not understanding admonition. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, can you describe it then?
Admonition is a term used in the monastic life of giving feedback and instruction to another person, so they're following the guidelines and developing in the Buddhist path according to maybe the monastic code or whatever it is. It's not criticizing. It's how we train each other. We're it's giving guidance to each other. It's maybe a better term. What was the term we decided on? We talked about this.
Advice.
We decided to change the word from admonition because Westerners don't understand it to advice. So that's the meaning of it. It's not to criticize. That's definitely not the meaning of admonition in the Buddhist context, in the monastic context. Anyway, so your question.
Well, because I'm thinking about when you're concerned with what others are doing, that really gets in the way of your practice.
Yeah.
This gets to be a big distraction.
Yeah.
And, for our minds. And I think that might be part, living in harmony is the reason why we have that restriction in the Dhirnavarsa. But I think also for the mind of just being not focused on what everybody else is doing.
Yeah, it's the way, if you read the beginning part of our Varsa materials, it's just stated right in there, it's the time for us to turn inward. Which I think is what most people's experience has been, and it's very beneficial. And then you kind of see, you know, some of these things we can let go. You know, the world isn't going to fall apart tomorrow.
I guess in some ways that falls under just not being concerned with worldly things.
Yeah, some of it.
Some of it's also, I mean, genuine concern for others.
Yeah, we care about each other, and that's, you know, when we're giving admonition properly, which is hard to do, actually. Remember when we had Venerable Jindy teach us about this some years ago? It had to be done with a motivation of compassion. And I remember her also teaching us about recognizing you might not be the person to give this feedback to another person because you might not be in a relationship with that person. You have to have your mind, your own mind together. You have to have some recognition of the other person and their capacity. You have to have recognition of the timing. Yeah, the situation. Are you the proper person? Are you able to do this with compassion? It's actually not so easy to do. You know, like personally speaking, a lot of times I would prefer just to not do this. But then, because I can't really live up to that. You know, it's hard to live up to. But then sometimes that doesn't work so well either. It's kind of, do your best. You know, what works is really people, if you can clean up your motivation, if you can be clear on your motivations, Venerable's helped me to see that, because I've talked to her about this before, like, if you don't have the skill, that is a problem. It's a real problem and it creates problems. But of the two, the motivation is more important and your skill will come along. You have to have both, but you're going to have the motivation before the skill comes along. And so you have to work on both. And then just what I find in my experience is that if I can keep my motivations together, the other person can recognize that I'm just a suffering, sentient being doing the best I can, and they appreciate that. You know, it doesn't always come out so well. But, you know, we come around and just like, thanks for trying. Didn't work so well. You tried. Well, that's how it goes for me. The thing is not to give up. You have to stay involved. And being involved doesn't mean you have to say anything. You know, you just don't check out in the monastic community.
I think the other thing, too, is that it's gotten really clear, and I've made a kind of a personal commitment this winter, is that I'm going to try to use Varsa to kind of really not only go inside, but to really pay attention to, am I modeling the things that I want to guide other people to do? You know, yeah. I'm so blinded by my own deportment, my own way that I think, the way that I handle myself. So the Varsa gives us a chance because we're not so much focused on other people. You get to catch yourself going, well, look at the way I just raced across that floor. Mm-hmm. Look at the way I just closed that door. Look at the way that I'm just eating my food. Look at the way that I'm dressing myself. Look at the way that I'm, what's my face look like? Mm-hmm. You know, it really is an opportunity to be able to work on one's own example.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I was thinking about that after the stand-up meeting today that I wasn't at, but the day before. You know, like, I was not mindful in my practice, which is exactly what we say when we take it, you know? And I'm really happy that you said something to me because it was proper even though we were in Varsa, you know, and I appreciated it. It's like, this is what we say. I will be mindful in my practice. Isn't that the words, exact words we said? Yeah, and so this is our time of year to really make that, you know, bring that into each day more, knowing that we're, blew it on the first day. Second day, whatever it was. But, you know, I got 3 more months. I'm like, it's uphill from here. Do not let your mind be uncontrolled.
Right. It's in response to that line, which is also a very good one to remember all.
Right. Yeah, and that's what happens. I was pretty uncontrolled today, too. Anything else? But I did learn something today. Everything I plan is the only thing I know. What I learned today was everything that I planned today is the only thing I know that isn't going to happen. That was my day.
Could you repeat about the motivation, how essential it is that you have the right motivation to attain serenity? What kind of motivation?
Basically, he was saying that there were 3 suitable motivations that would give you the momentum and the energy to do this. For some people who are not Buddhists, it might be to attain high levels of concentration, like form realms, formless realms. And for a Buddhist, that would eventually be quite unsatisfactory. In fact, the Buddha went out of his way. There was a king that had attained really these levels of concentration, and he was on his way to meet the Buddha, and he met him in a potter's shed, and the Buddha came there, and I don't think the man first knew he was the Buddha for quite a while, but he managed to convince this young king that that would never be satisfactory, and so the king pursued his practice, which is good because the king actually was killed shortly after that, and he would have been born in like a form or formless realm, and instead he was able, I don't know if he became an arhat or what, I don't remember that part of the story. So, you know, it gives people enough oomph to do what it takes to gain these realizations. The second one was reaching nirvana, you know, which is a amazing, magnificent achievement and attainment, and is quite worthy and admirable. Unfortunately, that you're not going to be able to help others too much in that situation. And so then the third one is the altruistic intention to become fully awakened and use that as your motivation. And I think that's really awesome when you think about these topics here, because especially the ones that relate to contentment or giving up activities or desires and all of that, to me, those can be woven in. Even giving up activities, you might think, oh, I'm not working for beings. No, you are working for beings. You know, this lifetime, this period of my life, I have these conditions to develop myself in this way. You know, it's like doing the internal work before you can do the external work. You can't just become a physician by deciding, I want to be a physician. You have to go through all the years and years of education and training to be able to do that. And this is no different, just longer. Does that make sense?
Can you state the first one in a few words again?
Yeah, it was to attain like the jhanas, the form and formless realms.
Yeah. That's considered a suitable motivation?
Yeah, for a non-Buddhist, it would be suitable. He called those suitable and, what's this word? Meaningful, authentic motivations for the practice of serenity, to attain rebirth in the form or formless realms. That might be, you know, very meaningful for someone, but it wouldn't be what we would want to do. Anything else? Okay, good. Okay, good. So this is an important topic, so don't ever give up on it. Try to just make some little time for it every day and educate yourself, because it will help us to develop all of our Mahayana aspirations. So may we spread any merit out from this time together and send it out in the form of light to all sentient beings, especially anyone who is suffering at this time, especially confused politicians. And anyone who's in any particular need.